Show.
It's the show you can listen to anywhere you like. You can wear what you like, or you can wear nothing at all. And you can sit or stand or even squat.
Go ahead, squat a little. You've earned it.
I'm squatting. And now your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. I am talking today again to Tim Mahoney, who is a filmmaker. His first two films are called Patterns of Evidence. One is The Exodus. The other is The Moses Controversy. The third one, which is in theaters February 18th, is called Patterns of Evidence, The Red Sea Miracle. There's so much here. Tim, I want to ask you again, is there any new information in this documentary, or are you pretty much just telling us what's been discovered that we haven't heard about? Because there's so many discoveries that just don't make the news, you know, and you would never hear that, let's say, 10 years ago, somebody makes a discovery. You mentioned this, is it an Austrian archaeologist, Manfred Bitek?
Manfred Bitek, yeah.
You said that, so he, in 2002, tells you there's no evidence for the Israelites living in Egypt. And then you see him in 2018, and he says there is evidence. What did he discover? Tell us again what he discovered, because this is all happening now. I mean, right. New information giving veracity to the Bible account.
When I met him in Jerusalem, what he told me was that there was a lake that he could see, that he could uncover. In his archaeological finding, a large lake was 20 kilometers long. But what was very unusual about this is that the name of the lake was not an Egyptian name. It was the name Gesem or Gesem. And Gesem is the Greek sort of Goshen. So it was the same, name as Goshen in the Bible. In other words, in the Septuagint, I think they call it Gesem. And so that's the Greek translation of it. But what we're trying to say here is that Manfred Bitek was saying that why in the world would there be a Semitic named lake in the middle of Egypt's Nile Delta unless it matched the story of the Bible of the Israelites coming in. And what he was uncovering was the arrival of the early Israelites in Egypt and their multiplication and their enslavement. He was the one who was able to go in there and start to show other archaeologists. Because what an archaeologist is supposed to do is they dig and then they record everything they have. They don't have to give interpretation right away. And they make it available to many other people.
Right.
And what other people would see was they saw the exact pattern of evidence of the arrival and of Joseph and his family. They saw all of that happening, but no one would admit it because of chronology, because the chronology of Egypt and the chronology of the Bible, they weren't matching. Egyptologists were trying to tell us that the Bible had to have happened at this particular time, 1250. So here's what's interesting, kind of funny. So the Exodus that didn't happen had to have happened at 1250 BC.
That's their claim.
That's the claim.
And so, they're saying it didn't happen.
Right. So the Exodus that didn't happen had to have happened at 1250.
Right.
When we say, yeah, but the pattern of evidence shows up earlier in Egyptians' history. Well, that's not the Exodus. And so what we started to realize was that, well, if you start to go back like a detective, and our films are made on logic. We call it dramatic logic. You look for the logic. And you're asking a question, well, you start with the Bible. What is the Bible telling us? And then you go to every source you can, and you document what they've written, what they've recorded in history, and you start to look and see the logic of what they're saying and the illogic at times of what they're saying.
Well, people get stuck on narratives. This is what I find interesting in history, and it's human nature, right? If I believe something and everyone around me is invested in believing it and textbooks are written which repeat it and it goes on and on and on, if somebody comes along and says, oops, there's a mistake, most people are going to be, excuse me, shut up. We don't want to hear about that because you're going to mess up everything we have worked on. And this happens in science. It happens everywhere. Once you challenge a paradigm, it's a big thing to shift the paradigm. And you're talking about that very thing. You're saying that there's evidence that says, no, there was an exodus that happened in 1450 BC, and that's going to challenge people all over the place because there's so much invested in this other chronology.
Well, in these films that we're doing, we're trying to help just the layperson understand. I'm making fairly sophisticated films, but actually children can understand them, because I unfold words, and you can. You know, I'll take you, and it's very visual. I created a tool called the Wall of Time, and when we start to see what people are saying when things happen, I show you exactly on a wall of time where it happened, and this helps to start to understand more clearly where biblical events are and where the evidence shows up. And the new film, the second film in the series, The Red Sea Miracle, is going to be on May 4th. This is part two of this investigation. I'm sorry, May 5th. May 5th is when we're going to be doing it. In a Fathom event, one night only, around the nation, over 800 theaters. And this is the second part of this investigation, where we're going to be looking at the trapping at a sea. So the Bible says that when the Israelites left, they journeyed across, they left going in a particular direction. They're heading towards the mountain, to Mount Sinai, to worship God. And they crossed the desert miraculously. And then they were told to turn and camp at a sea. So what I'm doing in the next investigation is I'm looking at the sea crossing potential spots. Some of them are near Egypt. And there's two views I'm looking at. One I call the Egyptian view, and they believe that the sea crossing happened at a marshy, reedy sea.
The place called the Sea of Reeds.
The Sea of Reeds,
and they
yep.
say that wouldn't be a big deal for them to get across it.
Right. It would be shallow. So it would probably be somewhere between, you know, depending on, I've heard different amounts, but in order for wind to blow, technically speaking, it'd have to be 3 to 7 feet deep. That's all the deeper it could
right,
be, because wind
right.
could not part that much water.
Right.
Now, the other group is called the Hebrew group, and they believe that the Israelites crossed the Sinai Peninsula, and they end up at the Gulf of Aqaba. And that is a much bigger miracle. So we're looking at two different...
How deep is the water in the Gulf of Aqaba where you think they crossed?
Well, I'm looking at four locations, and it's the deepest location is about 2,500 feet to 3,000 feet.
All right, that's a little scary. I don't know if I would have walked through waters that, you know, walls of water on either side that high, that's freaking me out.
It would have been a canyon of water,
yeah.
Yes.
And
yes.
What is the shallowest of these four locations?
There's two versions that have it up on the northern tip, and that probably would have been more like 10 feet. To 15 feet deep of water.
Yeah.
We're up on the northern tip. And then there's the Straits of Turan, which is the lower tip of the Gulf of Aqaba.
Yeah.
And we're going to be looking at that as well. So we've got those four different Gulf of Aqaba.
And what are you looking at? In other words, I'm not really clear. Do most biblical scholars concur at this point that it would have been the Gulf of Aqaba?
Well, they're divided. Now, Hebrew scholars are telling me that every time Moses writes and gives a geographical description, as well as other authors in the Bible, they always point to Yam Suf, the Sea that's crossed, is the Gulf of Aqaba. Moses tells us that he says that when God tells him the border of Israel for the Promised Land, it's supposed to be from the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba up to the Mediterranean Sea, the Sea of the Philistines up there. It goes. So that is telling us if Moses, which the Bible says he is the author, and he's writing, actually the Torah is one book. It's just been divided up. It's one book. He's writing this narrative and telling us the journey, and he's telling us that the boundary is here. To me, that's good case, and that's why I'm looking more at the Gulf of Aqaba. But it also then tells us that if this happened, this was a mighty, spectacular sea crossing.
Right.
I mean, if it happened, depending on where it happened, it might be the reason why nations trembled.
I was going to say, you know, there are miracles and there are miracles. The parting of the Red Sea, God intended it to be awesome and so staggering that they would never, ever, ever forget what he had done. So that's a clue right there that if it happened, which I think it did, it would have been awesome. God's able to do awesome. We'll be right back, folks. The film, The Red Sea Miracle, the part one is February 18th, part two, May 5th in theaters, one night only. Don't go away.
When I find my myself in times of trouble. Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom. Let it be.
Hey there, folks. I am talking to the director of these three feature films now, documentaries called Patterns of Evidence. The new one is called The Red Sea Miracle. And it is in two parts. So the first one airs February 18th, 2020, in theaters nationwide, one night only. It's a Fathom event. The second one, May 5th. Now, I got to tell you, the poster for this, a two-part Fathom event, you are in the poster. You kind of look a little bit like Indiana Jones with your hat. And then down below, there's what's obviously an Egyptian soldier in a chariot.
Yeah, that's actually Pharaoh, by the way.
Or Pharaoh.
Yeah, yeah, could be, yeah.
Whatever. But here's the thing. He reminds me a little bit. He looks strangely like Rudy Giuliani. Is that intentional?
No.
He just got a grimace on his face that I've seen Giuliani make on the news programs. But anyway, the point is that you are delving into, I like the term, historicity, right? To determine, is there real historical evidence for these things that many people dismiss as myths? The parting of the Red Sea, the story of the Israelites, all of that, it has a mythic quality, and it is mythic. The question is it also historical? Mm-hmm. So what is it that drove you, Tim Mahoney, to this investigation? Because a lot of people, I mean, you're not an archaeologist, but you've talked to so many, and somehow you've gotten sucked into this.
Yeah, I have. It's been 20 years. I have had interviews with some of the world's leading archaeologists, and the journey to them, both in Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Europe. I've been to Cambridge, Oxford. I've interviewed Benjamin Netanyahu, Shimon Peres. This is an enormous investigation. It's probably one of the biggest biblical investigations. I was going to say excavations. I'm investigating the excavations, but it's one of the biggest investigations I think that's ever been conducted in film. We have thousands of hours of footage, and we're just now starting to understand how to unfold it. And what's happening, Eric, 3,500 years ago, sounds like a long time, doesn't it? Do you realize how many generations, if a generation is 35 years, how many generations back is that?
9,000?
No.
900?
100.
100? I was going to say 100.
Were you? Well, there you go. So you're more of a history literature guy than the math person.
Yeah.
But same with me. But if you think about it, okay, only 100 generations back to the time of the Exodus.
Yeah.
We think, it says that God loves us for, like 1,000 generations. Well, when we're talking about 3,500 years, and we think about, myself, my daddy, my granddaddy, my great-granddaddy, all the way back, this story is not as old as you think it is, and because we're here for such a short time. And people have been asking these questions about these events, and for the most part, I think until recently, last several hundred years, questioning the Bible. And one of the first questions the very first question in the Bible is, did God really say, right?
And who asked that question? Satan? Yes.
So,
that's the question, right? That it's the kind of to insert a grain of doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're living. Since the Enlightenment, people have been more and more and more skeptical whether a God exists, whether he's the author of these words. But the general consensus in the secular culture is that these are just folk tales. It's kind of like, the Greek myths. They're nice stories. There may be some historical elements to it, but generally speaking, we can't take it seriously. But the narrative seems more and more to say precisely the opposite. We were just talking about Stephen Collins, who's discovered the biblical Sodom. I was reading that book last night. It is nothing less than staggering that in our lifetime, archaeologists and folks like you are discovering things that point dramatically in the direction of the veracity of the biblical text. It never seems to go in the other direction anymore. It seems more and more and more this information is coming out.
Yes, and what I'm I can tell you, when I'm filming, I'll go into a particular an area, let's say in Israel or Egypt, and I will learn about new things that are coming, and we're just lining them up.
Give us some hints.
Well, Shiloh, where the tabernacle was, they're uncovering information now and artifacts that they're going to be releasing in the future, and it's going to be profound. There are footprints that are showing up that they didn't realize were there. Giant footprints that I saw 2 years ago.
You're kidding.
You can see them.
Wait a second. Giant footprints?
Well, they were placed there, they believe, by the Israelites. And they see this as a possible place where the Ark of the Covenant and the Tabernacle would stay at a period of time, and the Israelites would pray and walk around in the shape of a footprint.
I'm a little lost. What you mean? So these are not actual footprints.
What they are is they're stone walls that are made in the shape of a foot, and they're walking into the land, coming up from the Jordan Valley, as the Israelites are making their way.
So this would have been a monument that the Israelites made in stone to look like gigantic footprints walking into the land.
That's correct, yep. And we just went and looked at those. And no one really saw them before. But now that you've got archaeologists, they were starting to go out there and they're starting to look for these things. They're using the Bible as it were, a map. And they're looking for things in the Bible. And the thing that has happened is that what I learned is that in the last, let's say, 50 to 100 years, like you said, there has been such criticism about biblical things that it became unpopular, and it actually became risky for your reputation or your career.
Right.
If you were an archaeologist and you were looking for evidence for the Bible, you would not advance yourself. You might not get a position at a university, because the world changed and turned on many ideas that were biblical. And that's the reason why when I've gone out, but I have in fact interviewed archaeologists who'd said this. In fact, I've got it on tape and I'm going to use it in the future. Oh, we talk about Bible stuff all the time. Oh, yeah, we say that matches the Bible. That matches the Bible. Oh, yeah, that does too. But we can't talk about it. We can't publish it. But he said to me, he said, but you know what? I'm about to retire, and I don't care anymore.
Hey, this is like the Ricky Gervais meme of our time. I don't care. I just don't care. I'll just say what I like. I just don't care. I think it's important for people not to care. Speak the truth and let the chips fall where they may. Mm-hmm. My goodness, it's really – isn't it tragic when people don't do that? Mm-hmm. It's sad when they're afraid. Look, I've seen this happen – not with the Bible, but with the Mycenaean era. Mm-hmm. People who know the story of Heinrich Schliemann, he believed a very similar thing about Homer, that this was historically accurate, not that there's cyclopses and things, but that Homer was real and he was writing about a real place in real time. People dismissed it as myth. He proved that it was not myth, that Troy existed, that Orchomenos existed, that Pylos, Mycenae, all these places actually existed. But it took him decades to get the establishment to take it seriously. And then we're seeing the same thing in spades with the Bible.
Yeah, exactly. And as I've been making, doing this investigation, I have seen that I would ask a scholar a question, and he would give me his first answer. But sometimes I'd come in there with almost like a deposition amount of questions, 80, 90 questions, and they're used to maybe 6 or 7. And by the time I get to the third round of the questioning, sometimes they'll say, I don't know. You're going to have to talk to so-and-so about that. But what has happened in scholarship is that scholars have learned to declare a position and then to defend it to their death. And the challenge that I have is if the Bible is what it claims to be, there are consequences for not believing it. And I remember in the last film, I interviewed Donald Redford and William Deaver and Doug Knight. All these men, one was from Vanderbilt, and William Deaver is a very famous biblical archaeologist, and all of them were raised in Bible-believing homes, and today they're agnostics. And so I said, well, the Bible says there's a consequence if you don't believe. And I think that's the reason why doing these investigations, helping people to see that there are patterns of evidence in the archaeology that people are not talking about for whatever reason, and they're not seeing the connection. I don't know. Sometimes it's dating issues. Other times it's just they just don't want to admit it. So there you go.
Well, and, there was a dating issue with we were mentioning Stephen Collins and the discovery of Sodom. That was a dating issue.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to confront it. He had to say, okay, am I wrong or is the dating wrong? But let's just be honest. Let's see if we can figure this out. And then he was also bumping up against the consensus. A couple of biblical scholars 100 years ago determined that Sodom had to be here. And everybody just sort of goes with that. And 100 years later, if you say, no, I think it's here, everybody says, shut up. It's been discovered and determined 100 years ago. We're not going to change. And I have to say it takes bravery and in some cases real faith. So I'm really grateful for you. We're going to come right back. We're going to continue talking about patterns of evidence. Go to patternsofevidence.com. This is too important to miss, folks. Patternsofevidence.com. We are talking with Tim Mahoney. He is the director of three feature films, Patterns of Evidence. The latest one is called The Red Sea Miracle, and it's part in two parts. This is big stuff. What do you go into in part two that we wouldn't have seen in part one?
Well, the reason we actually have even an idea about the Red Sea Miracle is really due to Sesame DeMille in many ways. I mean, I'm going to go back to the fact that the Ten Commandments that he made aired for the past 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
And I've gotten to know the DeMille family, and I've actually been able to use some of the DeMille footage and interviews with his granddaughter. And so we have a big understanding about the Bible, but I think I want to just not forget to thank Cecil B. DeMille for what he did by making those kinds of biblical stories, because he did them as accurately as he could. He did a lot of research in those stories. But today...
Well, we now know through archaeological evidence that Moses did not look that much like Charlton Heston.
Yeah, we do know that. Yes, right? That's right, right.
Wow.
But the other thing that I've do is I bring back to life some of the people who've spoken into this, like David Hume. In this next film, David Hume was a philosopher, a Scottish philosopher, and he challenged, he was sort of the beginning of people were challenging that a miracle was possible. And I know in your book, Miracles, you know that there are people that just can't understand that a miracle could break the laws of nature. And David Hume was the one, I think, that introduced that thinking in the beginning. And then we have...
And he was in the 18th century?
Yes, I believe so, 17th, 18th century.
I always forget the details. But yes, he was the one that really... militated against the idea of miracles, you know, the classic Enlightenment thinking that to be rational is to dismiss the miraculous as fairy tales.
And what's happened, though, is that there is a way to scientifically look at miracles. And C.S. Lewis, we actually have recreations of C.S. Lewis. I went to Oxford and filmed at his home at the pond where he and J.R.R. Tolkien would sit and talk. And we've quoted him in the, and so we our films are filled with recreations and dramatizations. Really big documentaries, but they're feature documentaries with docudrama in them.
Right.
And then we also have, I'm trying to think of all the different elements that we've put into them, but they're going to be talking with Craig Keener, too. I don't know if you know who Craig is.
Craig Keener, he wrote a two-volume magisterial work, academic work on miracles. Now, the idea that somebody in the academy would write a big, genuinely academic book on miracles is extraordinary. But it seems to me that the tide is shifting, that there are people willing to look more closely, who have the guts to look more closely and are willing to brave the slings and arrows of whether they get tenure in order to tell the truth.
Yes, and I was in an interview in Chicago, and I said, well, there's no one that has any real evidence of miracles today, is there? And I said, yes, there is. And he pointed to Craig Keener. So yeah. I contacted Craig Keener, went down there, and this two-volume set documents thousands of miracles that have happened.
Yeah.
And we're going to basically look at, do miracles happen today? The Red Sea miracle, are miracles just something that happened at the biblical times, or do they actually happen today? And what Craig Keener is going to show and demonstrate is that miracles are happening today. And I'm going to actually have a surprise in the film about that. So what's different about this next part?
A surprise? You can't do that. You got to tell us. Can't you give us a hint or something?
I'm going to demonstrate a modern-day miracle. That's the plan. That's the plan.
Are you serious?
Yes.
You're going to demonstrate? This sounds like a sleight of hand. Is this a rope trick? What is this?
No, I'm not into magic.
Yeah, okay.
I'm into miracles.
Okay.
And the issue is that miracles are hard to understand, and they don't I don't think a miracle is about a naturalistic coincidence.
Right.
Because there are things that are happening that are beyond explanation.
Yeah.
And so when we looked at putting all this together and wrapping up the Red Sea miracle, we have to look at the question of how do miracles happen. Now, there's not to say that God doesn't work in coincidence or something where you just happen to meet a person, you're thinking about them, and you both meet and you both talk.
Well,
about
and God
important.
Arranged that, but He did it in within the realm of time and space. What we're talking about, just to be clear, is that someone who is what we call scientistic, a scientific materialist who's scientistic in his thinking, says there is and cannot be anything out of the material realm. They make this statement. Now, here's the irony. That statement alone is not a scientific statement because you can't know whether there's anything, but you can say, we don't know. You can be an agnostic.
Yep.
But they declare there's nothing beyond the realm of time and space that can be discovered with science. So what we're talking about, we're saying that, yes, there is, that God is outside of time and space. He created time and space, and He can and does periodically enter time and space. And to us, it's a miracle because you're sort of injecting information from beyond time and space. So it's really not that complicated. The only question is, do you believe in God?
Right. And the issue of our understanding of who God is goes back to Moses. Moses wrote the Torah. And the very beginning, when it says, in the beginning, God created, this goes back to the very understanding of that this man who actually met with God at a burning, at a burning bush and came back and brought these people out. There's something important for us to know about this.
I think we're going to a hard break. Am I right? We're going to a hard break. We'll be right back. Stick around.
Showed us the sun, but not as bright in life as the real one.
Hey there, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. I'm talking to my friend Tim Mahoney. He's the director of a number of feature films, Patterns of Evidence. You can go to patternsofevidence.com. The first new one is in theaters February 18th, one night only. The second one, May 5th, one night only. We've just got a segment left. Tim, tell us, are people actually searching for evidence of the drowned army of Pharaoh 35 centuries ago? I mean, it seems to me that, if I had the money, I would, everybody wants to know.
Yeah.
What can we know?
Right. Is there evidence of Pharaoh, his army and chariots on the seafloor? And people have been searching, yes, for the last 25 years they've been searching. And I've actually I started with that. I mean, I started with going to Egypt, hearing about this, fascinated by the fact that there might be evidence, coral-encrusted chariot wheels. And we're going to go back and we're going to revisit these, what I call Exodus explorers, who have been searching in places that others have basically dismissed. There's one thing I'll say about an Exodus explorer. There are people that have degrees that that never go look, in my opinion, for something. And there are people who are passionate about the Bible, and they say, why isn't somebody looking for this?
Yeah.
And they go off, and they head off, and they start diving for chariot wheels. Well, I find that interesting.
Yeah.
I like the fact that people are searching for evidence. And I ask the question, is it a crime to search for evidence of the Bible?
Well, I mean, the only problem is it's kind of like these you know, there are these series on the search for Bigfoot, and the series go on and on and on until they stop making money.
Yeah.
They never find Bigfoot. Same thing with UFOs, whatever. I think that, you know, you want to be serious about this. We're talking about the Bible, and it's one thing. We all want to believe this and that, and some people don't want to believe it. The question is, what can we know? So have you encountered anyone who has found anything that you think could be the real thing?
What we're going to look at is we're going to look at evidence. There are people that have pointed to and videotaped what is physical evidence.
Of what?
Of wheel shapes, of coral-encrusted shapes. We actually have some bones that were human and animal bones that were brought up. That we're going to be, we bring
from the bottom of the Red Sea.
From the bottom of the Red Sea, yes.
Okay.
And they go to a forensic specialist to look at. And we're going to be looking, we're going to be talking to the marine biologists who are going to basically looking at the same footage. They're going to be giving their interpretation of what this is. Obviously, something happened where they did, these are real bones. I mean, but the question is, where did those bones come from? How do you identify those bones? And what are these shapes? Are these shapes there? And then, are they really connected to Pharaoh's chariots or chariot wheels? The other thing we're going to look at is we're going to hear from is eyewitness testimony. And I actually had this.
What are you going to find somebody 3,500 years old and hook them up to a mic? What are
no,
you going to do?
I never thought of it that way.
You
but
should.
No, yeah. No, but we have people that have been searching who are, I believe, credible, who have seen something. And I'm going to.
What do you mean something?
They've seen a chariot wheel.
Okay, but they cannot reproduce it, or they didn't take a photo.
Yeah, you're going to hear the story of how this came about and what happened. It was a fairly traumatic situation that they are in, because you see, when they go out to those areas, they're not getting like dive support from an archaeological boat. They're sometimes having to swim out a half a mile, and they're diving deep, and they're trying to do things that are very, very, very difficult to do.
Hmm.
And then I ended up having a lie detector test done just to double check. You know, I got a guy who does federal, he works for the federal government, and he takes lie detector, he gives lie detector tests to people. So I'm going to look and explore this big question about the evidence that people have seen or they have pointed at. By the way, you cannot touch coral. You're not. It's against the law. You can go to prison in Egypt, and you don't want to go into prison in Egypt if you bring up a piece of coral.
Right.
All you can do is photograph it. The other challenge you have is that if something's related to the Bible, it's very, very politically challenging to get permission to go look for things because of the Israel, Egypt, and all these different
things.
See,
this is what makes it so. I found the same thing in Greece in my investigations, and it's always funny how human beings screw everything up. You would think that everybody would be interested in the truth, but it turns out, no, some people are interested in suppressing a certain narrative. They don't care. So it's fascinating. I hope people will go to theaters on February 18th and on May 5th, and they can find out more information at patternsofevidence.com. So what are some exciting things you can leave us in the last couple of minutes we have left?
Well, I think that what I've seen with our films is that people have become so encouraged. It does a couple things. If you have family members or friends that you have been wanting to talk about the Bible, this film will give you so much to talk about. If you want to find a way to enter into a conversation, and really on an intellectual level and on a very creative level, they will not be disappointed.
Yeah.
Well, these films have always been five-star award-winning films, and you're going to have a lot to talk about over dinner or whatever.
Right.
But you're in your own faith. What people tell me, I asked this one man, I said, what happens after you see these films? He goes, I get bold. He goes, because, you know, I knew, but this just makes it so much more exciting. People's faith are getting on fire. My faith is on fire. You know what? You can be doubtful and you can have all these things. You're kind of half-hearted. You see it in sports sometimes. You see a team that doesn't believe they can win, and guess what? They don't. But when a team gets fire in their belly, when you as a person who starts to understand that we have a faith that's historical and you start to connect to that, you aren't the same person. You are not the same person. I'm not the same person. I become a much more bolder person because I actually have something that I know. I know that there's something that has where we've come from, and I know where we're going. And this is what this biblical text is showing me. And it's changing in this world. We call this film company Thinking Man Films. And I think it's time for people to start thinking and thinking more richly about what they believe. And I'm going to provide for you. I'm doing a lot of the work. You can come along on this journey with me and see the Red Sea Miracle and go to patternsofevidence.com. Yeah. Get your tickets. Bring a whole group of people.
I honestly think that I hope everybody will go, and I hope they will bring a lot of friends. Folks, we haven't had stuff like this before. I really believe that all this kind of stuff is going to lead to revival, because once people begin to understand that these things are true and the Bible is true, it changes everything. Tim Mahoney, thank you so much. Congratulations, folks. Go to patternsofevidence.com. Do not miss this.
It'll get dimmer, dimmer, light the path below above and lead us on to love.
You were young and your heart was an open book.
Hey there, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. We've got a couple seconds left. This is the best part of the show, okay? Now, before we get to the best part of the show, Albin wants to confront me on something.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. Hold on, Albin, because I just want people to understand what it is. That you've all day long, you've been struggling. You didn't want to say it. You do want to say it. And I said, Albin, if you got something to say to me, you say it on the air. I'm ashamed of nothing. Do you understand?
Okay.
I apologize for nothing. And before I even let you do that, I got to remind people while they're listening, MyPillow.com. If you do not use the code ERIC, you do not get our big discount. I even said to sweet Suzanne, my wife,
yeah,
I said, Suzanne, she's ordering sheets for, I think, for her mom or something. I said, Suzanne, make sure you use the code ERIC because you get a gigantic discount. And you can tell all your friends. I don't care if they've heard of the show. I don't care if they know who ERIC is. By the way, I am ERIC. But you got to use the code ERIC, okay? That's the most important thing I wanted to get across to our audience. Everything on MyPillow.com, everything, you can use the code ERIC. You get a huge discount. Now, Albin, you had something deep and dark you wanted to share.
I know.
If you got anything to share, you share it on the air.
I know,
pal.
And I told you I wanted to do it privately, but look, if you're gonna do this, I know you're big enough to take criticism, okay? I'm only going to do this because I know that about you. I know you want people to be honest with you and straightforward, and you can handle the truth. So I just want to let you know you were caught on a hot mic the other day yelling at our engineer. You probably don't even know his name. Our engineer?
What's his name?
James.
Yeah.
So
Whoa. Yeah. First of all, you're telling me I yelled at James?
Yes. Yes, you did.
That is baloney.
You didn't know the mic was on, but
I don't yell. That is the dumbest thing. What, you
we have
it on?
Yeah, we have it, of course.
Like, you know, just to prove I'm a big man, if you have it, I dare you. Go ahead, play it.
Okay, James. Now you listen.
I can't touch this.
That's not me. That's MC Hammer.
I can't touch this.
Hey. What did I tell you? You hear me? I said 70s music. Did you hear me? You need to open up ears, pal. What's your name, James? Hey, when I say 70s, okay, the 80s is not the late 70s. It's the 80s. Do not let it happen again or I will gut you like a fish. You understand me?
Like, did you hear yourself there?
I don't think that was my voice.
No, that... Oh, come on, Eric. That was you.
I think I was hacked.
Yeah, right.
Why,
you were
hacked. Really think that was my voice?
Yes.
Didn't sound like me.
Look, I try to be professional. I try to be cool, calm, and collected myself. And so
I would never behave like that, Albin.
Yeah, I think you did.
I don't think I'm capable of saying something as nasty as I will gut you like a fish. You did that. Listen,
what?
You want to play that game?
What?
Punk? I wasn't going to do this, but we have saved a tape where you, Mr. Vanity, were caught on. Let's play that.
Wait a minute. Who's on camera? Who's on camera one?
That's you.
What are you? What? No. What? What the? What are you doing? I told you, do it. You're supposed to make me look like George Clooney, not Don Knotts. What? Okay, that's it. You're fire. What's your name? You're fire.
Alvin.
No, what? Who are you?
That person's a volunteer. Calm down.
Now, that's not me.
You're going to say that wasn't you?
That's not me.
Alvin, nobody refers to Don Knotts but you.
Oh,
it was you, Alvin.
No, you're
you. It was you all along.
All right.
You broke my heart, Alvin.
You broke mine. You broke mine first.
I tell you, you know what? It's good that we're open and honest on this program.
Well,
the fact of the matter is that well may have been my voice. I'm going to contest it. But I will just say, if that was my voice and I threatened to gut James like a fish, James, you know that probably I would never do such a thing. And so I apologize even for suggesting it. And Albin,
yes.
Just so you know, if you pull a stunt like that on me again, I just want you to know I've got more tape on you. And I will, if you push me, I will play it. I wanted to end on a harsh note today, folks, and I have succeeded.
You have succeeded.
Fantastically.
Sir.
Thank you.